There are about 200,000 American and British forces already in striking distance of Iraq, with small contingents from Australia, the Czech Republic, and several other nations. But even when deployments are complete, the total will be less than half the force that was amassed for the Persian Gulf War 12 years ago, and the number of nations represented will be much smaller. U.S. military planners openly envisage a different strategy for this war, should it come. Michael Vickers directs strategic studies at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments in Washington, D.C. He's a former Army Special Forces officer and a CIA operations officer. Joins us in our studios. Mr. Vickers, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
And why do U.S. and British military sources seem so confident that this force is large enough and well deployed enough to be able to do the job?
Well, number one, U.S. and allied capabilities have improved rather dramatically since the first Gulf War in the intervening 12 years, while Iraqi forces have atrophied substantially, both in size and in quality. By some measures, U.S. forces are a factor of 10 or more improved over where they were 12 years ago.
And I've heard Iraqi forces are about a third of what they were?
Third to a half, depending on how you count it. And then the other issue, of course, is that assuming that a big chunk of the Iraqi military will sit out the fight or surrender to allied forces or actually turn their guns on Saddam, and so that drives planning a bit.
How wise, in your mind, is the assumption that a substantial number of Iraqi troops will either sit out, immediately surrender, or even turn on the regime?
Well, last time a number surrendered, and you know, the Iraqi military is broken down into really the Special Republican Guard, the Praetorian Guard, then the Republican Guard, about 80,000, and then the rest of the armed forces are more conscripts with very, very low morale, and a number surrendered last time. But military planning doesn't really assume that, and that's why you have this 200,000-man force. The debate before the war and the months leading up to this impending conflict really had a range of forces required from the few thousands to a high of 250. Mm-hmm. So they're really trying to buy themselves a lot of insurance and not taking any of that for granted.
Based on what you know, based on what you would surmise, what might the first 48 hours of a war look like?
By comparison, in the first night of the war in 1991, 150 targets were struck in the air campaign. This time, the number could be 10 times that number.
What would these targets be?
Mainly air defense. Saddam has concentrated a lot of his air defense capabilities in Baghdad. And then they would move on to command and control sites, as they're euphemistically described, but presidential palaces, the leadership structures of Iraq. What's different about this war is ground forces would likely move simultaneously with the air campaign, and so they could be outside Baghdad in a very short period of time.
What about the possibility that Saddam Hussein or the forces around Saddam Hussein will try and make the city of Baghdad a kind of last redoubt and force U.S. and British forces to come in there and individually confront Iraqi soldiers?
Well, Baghdad is a very large city, but it's not a homogeneous city. There are 1 million Shia in the city, and the precision bombing campaign will likely make it very difficult for Saddam and the Iraqi senior leadership to retain much control of their forces. Their communications will be cut off. They'll be targets themselves, and so they'll be worried about their own security. And so orchestrating a coordinated defense might be difficult.
I guess we know anecdotally from a lot of testimony that during the last Gulf War, Saddam Hussein apparently took refuge in homes of individual Iraqis. With Osama bin Laden still, far as we know, alive and at large, there seems to be a renewed interest in making physical possession of Saddam Hussein, perhaps even making him available for trial for war crimes, to be a real priority. What can be done about that?
Well, it's a difficult problem. I mean, the administration has tended to downplay the importance of personalizing this about Saddam. You know, they'll target him as a leadership asset. He may be killed in the war, but they don't want to get into the situation of they have a successful war and then why haven't you caught Saddam?
As we speak, there are anywhere from 16, 20, the number could rise to several score of people, many from Western countries and Australia, who have agreed to be human shields. Will this, near as you can tell, affect Allied military strategy?
The goal of the overall campaign is to minimize the damage to civilian infrastructure as much as possible, because the goal afterwards is to rebuild Iraq. And so now if human shields are at presidential palaces where Saddam is or others, then they could be placed in harm's way. The U.S. commander in charge, Tommy Franks, the so-called combatant commander, has said that, you know, they will do what they can, but they can't guarantee that they won't get struck. And so that's one of the uncertainties is if we get closer to war, what happens to people there voluntarily in Iraq, or does Saddam, as he did last time, hold some? We just have to see.
Mr. Vickers, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Michael Vickers directs strategic studies at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments in Washington, D.C.